Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is the Compliance Guy.
The Compliance Guy.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is the Compliance Guy. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, everybody. Happy Tuesday. Welcome to another episode of The Compliance Guy. Again, opportunity to welcome, as always, my very good friend, Terry Fletcher, out on the West Coast, who's gotten up early to join us for this segment today, as we affectionately refer to it as a hashtag Terry Tuesday episode. And I want to say thank you to each and every single one of you for tuning in, logging on, and hanging out with us just for a little while as we get to discuss compliance. So good morning, my friend. How are you?
I'm good. Even with the time change of losing an hour, we're good out here. Finally, yeah. Not having any rain, I think, for a little while.
Well, we have been inundated with rain, and there's more rain on the way, and it's kind of wreaking havoc on certain areas here in the South. But, you know, I fully expect at some point we'll be seeing drought conditions during the summer, which,
right.
You know, as somebody That's who true. Is, you know, and a lot of folks may not know this about me, you know, but we're agriculturalists, my family and I, you know, we grow different types of things, obviously, you know, grapes for the winery and blueberries and things of that nature. And, you know, we have a flower farm, fresh cut flowers, you know, that we provide for the florists all around the counties where we live and that we serve. So for us, you know, water is a blessing, but it can also be a curse. But enough about that. Let's talk about compliance, because I'm really liking the topic that you sent over to me last night, which is the OIG in their most recent updated compliance guidance document has finally put into words something that we have always kind of known as an unspoken, which is quality of care, and how it ties directly into the world of regulatory compliance. So let me stop there, because I don't want to steal any thunder from you, and you take it away, and I'll fill in any gaps that you feel I need to fill in.
Yeah, we got some, as you know, we got some updated guidance last November from OIG. It's called the HHS OIG GCPG, and then anyone can look it up, but it's the General Compliance Program Guidance from November 2023. And it's 91 pages, which, people, that's short. So if you've ever read compliance, that's really short. But there are some pages in it, and I actually, you know, I'm reviewing it all the time, just going back to it to see if I missed anything. And one thing I did notice, which I thought was interesting, is they have a section 5, which starts on page 76. And it says other compliance considerations. So it's not even in the forefront. Everyone always reads the main compliance issues, you know, the 8 or 9 compliance things you have to do, but they forget to keep reading. It's kind of like clickbait on articles. They just look at the title, but they don't keep reading. And when you get to page 76, it talks about quality and patient safety, as Sean said. And it's saying that quality and patient safety are often treated as wholly separate and distinct from compliance. So it says, and compliance programs don't often contain quality and patient safety components, but HHS, CMS, FDA, and other agencies, and they say this right in the document, along with OIG and DOJ, they said we've long emphasized the importance of quality and patient safety. And they said they've investigated and settled cases based on the submission of false claim for care that is, they call it, materially substandard, resulting in death or severe harm to patients. And what I found interesting, the reason I wanted to bring up this topic, again, because it's in the other section, is because it seems like it is heading towards value-based care and looking at the patient's total clinical picture, not just the the reason today or the limited reason for the encounter on any given day. But they're trying to make compliance committees and compliance plans and compliance programs be a little bit more inclusive. And, you know, you're furnishing a lot of entities are furnishing direct patient care, hospitals, long-term care facilities, residential care. You know, you've got nursing, therapy, other clinical services, and you're referring to these places. So it talks about the compliance officer not only should be responsible for implementing safety and, you know, what we're dealing with as far as quality into your compliance plans, but you have to address safety and compliance risks, just like you do for any other area of compliance and who you're referring to. So it talks about, you know, incident reviews. Let's say you're referring to physical therapy or you're referring to cardiac rehab or, you know, something like that. You're developing relationships with outside entities. Again, I'm just seeing this value-based care issue all over the place. And that's not one of my areas of expertise, but I can see it. But have you, you know, do you know if that's a quality place as well? Do you know what their risk assessments are? And I know sometimes people might think it's unfair that, well, I should just worry about my own entity. Well, if you're referring to places and you've got a place that may have failed a compliance audit or they don't have appropriately credentialed clinicians and you don't know what their billing practices are, medical necessity issues, I think your compliance risk could be kind of, I don't know, it could be definitely invited. And now I'm looking at AI tools and software and have that they've been vetted for safety and biases before entering contracts for adoption. So I know that was a whole mouthful, Sean, but there's just so much going on with patient safety and quality. And as we get into, you know, artificial intelligence and you get into referrals and the fact that it was put in the compliance plan, you know, that they came out with the update. One thing you had said to me that, I don't know, years ago when we first met, you said, if the OIG is looking at it, then we need to be looking at it. And so I always remember that if they add something to their published guidance, then we need to be aware of what that means to us and what it means going forward in our practices for our providers, because they don't just put things in just for the heck of it. They put it in because they must have found something along the way that was a problem. And then I'll send it over to you because I can't imagine that's not their kind of corrective action to now address it in updated guidance.
Yeah. I mean, a lot to unpack, right? So, you know, first, you know, one of the things that I would point out, and you did a really good job of it, but to reemphasize, you know, when you are a solo physician or a 2 to 3 doctor, or maybe even a 5 doctor practice, you know, creating a compliance committee is difficult, right? Because sometimes it's just the practice administrator, the doctor may say, I don't have time for that crap. You know, and maybe the practice administrator or the office manager, you know, has, you know, the MA who, you know, doubles or triples as the front office, you know, coordinator and the coder.
Sean, I had a practice that had 100 physicians last week, not to interrupt you, but they said, yeah. Hey, do you do compliance plans? Yes, I do. And I gave them a quote, which was in, you know, thousands of dollars. And they said, do you just have a $500 book that we can plug and play? Keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. I get people all the time that reach out to me and they're like, hey, can I just buy a compliance template from you? And I'm like, well, I do have templates that I've created over the last, you know, 25 years, that I've been solely focused on regulatory compliance, but they're templates and they are useless unless you do a gap analysis and unless you understand the root cause to your problems, because creating a policy from a template without understanding will it or will it not be effective is not creating an effective compliance program. And that's what the government wants. They want a culture of compliance, and all you're doing is taking a bunch of words on a piece of paper and slapping your practice name onto it and hoping that if somebody you know, pops the hood to take a look underneath at the engine, you know, they're not going to recognize that you've given them, you know, a two-cylinder engine when they were expecting a Hellcat. And for those of you that don't know what a Hellcat is, it's a Dodge Challenger or Charger that has this engine called a Hellcat. I digress. Anyways, the point that I'm trying to make here is you can't kind of half these things, right? You're either all in or you're not in at all. There's no, well, we'll do this part of it, but I don't want to do that part of it. And I'll do this part of it, but I don't want to do that part of it. It doesn't work that way. I mean, there are things that you can pick and choose as to whether or not you're going to include them in your compliance plan based on the type of entity that you are and whether or not those aspects of the OIG guidance are applicable to your organization. But you can't look at something and say, well, you know, I know we should be doing it, but it's cost prohibitive, so I'm not going to do it. It's the same thing I tell clients all the time. You could either pay a little bit of money up front, even though I say a little bit, it's still not cheap. But with respect to what the punishment on the back end could be, it's a drop in the bucket compared to what some of these practices are hit with as fines or penalties. There's a couple of things that I wanted to point out, though. When we're, you know, traditionally, compliance committees have not included individuals from the quality and patient safety team. And they need to be a part of that because, again, they're looking at the quality of care. They're looking at continuity of care. These are individuals who can make determinations as to whether or not, you know, care a patient was provided was up to what, you know, would be considered generally accepted standards of medical practice or whether or not the care was substandard. One of the other things that I always talk about, and Terry, you and I've had a lot of these conversations, are corrective action plans. Corrective action plans are of critical importance because they demonstrate the good faith efforts on the part of an organization and individuals to recognize the root cause of a problem, to understand what was versus what should be, and then through common sense approach, through authoritative guidance that's readily available from CMS, OIG, DOJ, whoever it may be, you create corrective actions to close those gaps. But the thing that I always caution people about is, again, if you create a corrective action plan, it's not something that you're doing just for kicks and giggles or as a way to pacify an investigator from a governmental agency. You're doing it to make a good faith effort to remain compliant with generally accepted standards of care, with guidance, regulations, statutes, acts, policies that are published from the government or even from commercial payers. And I think a lot of people, you and I actually had about a 30-second conversation about this before we went onto the podcast today. The OIG doesn't just look at the government. Commercial insurance companies also can get OIG involved because OIG says, listen, if a physician or a hospital or a health system or a DME supplier or a freestanding ambulatory surgical center or infusion center is doing this to commercial payers and their beneficiaries, bet you're doing it to Medicare, Medicaid, CHAMPIS, VA, TRICARE members as well. So we're going to take a look at what these special investigative units are identifying as possible fraudulent and or abusive behavior. And we're going to dig in and we're going to see what we can find. And we may refer this to the Department of Justice, who will prosecute on behalf of all payers. So
Sean, did you see the one? So you saw what I sent you, right? Do you have it pulled up by any chance? Because I wanted to point out something that I thought was interesting because I highlighted some sections.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about it. I actually have it right here in front of me.
Yeah. Look at page 78 of the, of this update. And one thing that I noticed about this, and I found this, I just find this fascinating to me. That's the, I guess the best word. And also for the listeners too, Sean will have this on the website. We'll make sure you get a link because obviously the hashtag Terry Tuesday is audio only, but we'll make sure you get a link if you don't know how to look it up on Google or whatever. But one of the things that that they put into this, again, other in this section five, are new entrants into the healthcare industry. But that's not the thing that I'm kind of fascinated by. On the Compliance Guy Roundtable, we went over some things around time for E&M services. And I had found an obscure entry in one of the things for shared and split visits, where for some reason CMS added something about, I think it was G in some of their 30.6.0.10, that they were going to look objectively at anyone who used time for E&M and wasn't medically necessary. And it was buried. And so now I'm looking here on page 78 out of 91, and I'm looking at something that they buried. And it's interesting because I just had a very big new client that just engaged with me saying, we have a problem because we had a company that did an audit for us, and I knew the company, they only used AI, so it wasn't a good audit. And they basically were like, and we thought we did okay, but now we're finding that we're having to send back over $1 million in refund self-reporting because they didn't take into account the medical necessity. So look what they've buried again. Look at page 78, this the third part that I highlighted. It said, talks about new entrants in healthcare industry.
Right.
Well, before that, I'm sorry, it's in the second part. It says, therefore, entities should ensure that any claim reviews and audits include a review of medical necessity of the item or service by an appropriately credentialed clinician. Entities that do not include clinical review of medical necessity in their claims audits may fail to identify important compliance concerns relating to medical necessity. I thought this was interesting because then it goes on in the third part, they talk about, simply put, business practices are common in other sectors, create compliance risk in healthcare. And then they go into the criminal, civil, and administrative liability. But again, they talk about new entrants, they have to take steps, you know, any kind of solid understanding of those fraud and abuse laws. But I just find it interesting that they would bury medical necessity review. Why not put that on the forefront? I think one thing that people don't understand, and I know you and I have probably banged our hand against the wall about this, you and I could look at, I'm probably, just because you're more into compliance, fraud, waste, and abuse, I can look at a claim for 10 different specialties, not every specialty, but my main one says cardiology, let's say, and I could look at the claim and tell you if it's right or wrong just by the codes. But that doesn't mean I can tell you if it was medically indicated or medically necessary to do it. I can just tell you if the codes are right. So then I have to dig deeper. So if you're looking for, you know, an audit saying, well, all the coding's right, so we passed. And then I'm saying, well, hold on a second. Okay, so the patient didn't have chest pain, didn't have angina, didn't have any kind of indications, didn't have an abnormal EKG. Why did you do that heart cath? Why did you do that intervention if it wasn't medically indicated? Or, and better yet, people that are still billing phone calls for non-medically necessary services to give, you know, routine test results. And they're like, yeah, but I got paid. And it's like, okay, because the code may have been correct, was it medically necessary to do? And now I see this compliance update and I'm like, they buried it on page 78, but that gives OIG, HHS, and anyone who is going to be coming down on you like a hammer saying, you didn't read the rules. It's on page 78 instead of on page 1 through 5, which people usually stop after page 10, you know. You have to refer to this stuff all the time in the work that you do. Why do they bury it? Same thing with the time. Why do they, is it to cover them to say, we're just trying to see if everyone gets through the whole thing. If they really take what we're saying seriously and read the entire document and then implement it instead of just taking notes and just, you know, saying like we were saying, plug and play with an outline or a template. Do they bury it on purpose? To kind of test practices to see, let's see if they really are understanding compliance and understanding the published guidance, that, because it's weird that they wouldn't put something so important as medical necessity in the forefront.
I know,
that's a loaded question. I know you probably don't know the answer, but I'm interested in your perspective.
I'm going to answer your question with something. So, you know, as we talked about briefly on the Monday roundtable, you know, I was in the hospital for 5 or 6 days and spent some quality time with folks in the ICU. But I came out of the hospital, and my first afternoon that I was home, and I'll show you where I'm going with this, because it's crazy how our minds think alike, even when we haven't spoken for a week. I came home, and instead of going to bed after my heart cath and, you know, having, you know, spent that quality time in the hospital, instead of going to the bed and turning on Netflix or Amazon Prime or Tubi or whatever, I came into my office because my wife wasn't at home. She went back to the office, and yeah, I sat down
like that.
Yeah. I sat down at my desk and I started writing a blog, and I'm about 3 pages into it now, about 925 words. And it says, and it's entitled, "The State of Healthcare is Deplorable." And you'll get to read it probably in the next few days when I finish it. But here's the section that I want to read, because it's so crazy that you brought up medical necessity, and I just want to hit this. And this is just a small excerpt from it. "If you want to ensure the highest quality of care for patients, let the clinicians create the policies and procedures. Let them self-govern how they deliver care. If you do not have a clinical degree, stay the hell out of the way, because you are nothing more than a liability." Now, go back to what you just read in that section, Terry, of the HHS OIG guidance. And it said in the section that we were just looking at, in section A, just above new entrants into the healthcare industry, "Therefore, entities should ensure that any claims, reviews, and audits include a review of the medical necessity of the item or service by an appropriately credentialed clinician." Look, I know that there's going to be a lot of folks that listen to this podcast who are coders, certified coders, auditors, and they're going to say, "That's crap, Sean, Terry. I can do a medical necessity review. I do them all the time." You know, the people at Medicare who aren't clinicians do medical necessity reviews. Just because you do something doesn't mean it's right. I am not a clinician. I've been auditing medical records for 30 years. I will never...
I'm a former clinician, and I do audit for medical necessity.
But that's the difference. You have a BSN. Okay.
I'm not a practicing nurse, but I do.
But it doesn't matter. You went through all the clinical courses to determine your competency to be able to pass the state nursing board.
That's true.
In California or wherever you got your nursing degree. Okay. Right. There's a difference between somebody who took the primer for the AAPC or a HEMA test to become a certified coder for anatomy and physiology, which is like 2 pages, versus somebody who went through 2 semesters of anatomy and physiology, right? Listen, when I was in school, I went through biology 1, biology 2. I went through chemistry 1, chemistry 2. I went through anatomy 1, 2, and 3. I mean, you know, I went through clinical diagnostic, you know, in radiology. I mean, listen. I am still not somebody who will go back and say this service.
So you're not a doctor, but you play one on TV, is what you're saying.
Yeah, something like that. But you know, I am not somebody who will sit on the stand and testify to the fact that something is clinically necessary, right? I don't talk about medical necessity in the sense of like when I'm talking about something from a medical necessity standpoint. Here's what I'm looking at, okay? Did a physician or non-physician practitioner document enough information in the medical record to lead a reasonable person to believe that what they did was appropriate, reasonable, and necessary. Now, I cannot call into consideration the clinical judgment of a physician, because I'm going to sit on the stand, and the first thing that a prosecutor or a criminal defense attorney is going to say to me is, Sean, did you go to medical school? Did you go to nursing school? Do you have any type of credential that sits on your wall that says MD, DO, PA, NP, CNS, whatever it may be? The answer is no. And they're going to say, Your Honor, we would like to impeach the testimony of this witness. Or prior to going into a trial where I'm giving courtroom testimony, they're going to file motions in limine. They're going to file a motion to to compel the court to exclude. It's called a Daubert motion. And sometimes you have to have a Daubert hearing. And if you're an expert that has a Daubert filed against you and it's successful, kiss your career goodbye. You're done. So for me, if the OIG says you need someone with clinical credentials to perform a medical necessity review, I can't go to the OIG and say, hi, I'm Sean Weiss, and I've got 10 certifications in coding, billing, and compliance, none of which are clinical, but I'm telling you the services are medically necessary. They're going to look at me and they're going to be like, who cares? Get out of here.
They did say appropriately credentialed. So they didn't actually say clinically credentialed. Just saying.
Well, they did. They actually did. It says appropriately credentialed clinician.
Oh, clinician. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It does. So
but it just the thing that I think is interesting though, why put it in the back of the document?
I've learned not to question how the government does things.
Well, yeah. But why is safety and quality under other compliance? I mean, some people might say, "What's other? Nothing." You know,
because what's actually codified in the federal regulations may not necessarily speak to, like, medical necessity is not codified in the law, right? Medical necessity is a term. It's a term that's used, right? We didn't actually get a definition of the term medical necessity until we had the big Cigna case years ago, right? Where, the Thomas Love settlement with Blue Cross Blue Shield, where the court said, we need you, insurance company, to give us what your internal definition of medical necessity is, because you cannot hold a clinician to a standard without telling them what that standard is. So, you know, it's listed under other, and this is just my best guess, right? It's listed under other because it's not codified in the law. That would be my guess.
It sounds like it's subjective and objective.
100% it is. And that's why the government does it the way they do. Remember, the government writes things so that it leaves it open to the ability to create a narrative that fits a suspected crime. That's why they do it.
Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, I guess the thing to take away from it is the fact that it's under quality and patient safety.
Yes.
So, you know, if you're, and I think the biggest thing we wanted to bring to light about this, when you are looking to update your compliance plans, and it's not if you do, you need to. If you haven't updated since, you know, the Hoover administration, or if you haven't looked at anything prior to the pandemic, or even since we ended the public health emergency, look at the date of that updated published guidance. HHS OIG is saying that, you know what, November 2023, this is what we've come up with that we're not seeing. They don't issue guidance unless they're not seeing something that needs to be there when they do come in and take a look.
Yeah.
So you need to read the entire document. Make sure you go through your own compliance model or plan, program, whatever you want to call it. And then for those practices out there that think they're, well, we're too small, we don't have a compliance committee, we don't have a compliance officer. First of all, it's not an option. If you are billing to any federal program, whether it be Medicare, Medicaid, TRICARE, whatever, It's required. Required means mandated. You That's have right. to have a compliance plan.
It has been required since 2010 with the adoption of the Affordable Care Act.
Right. It was recommended, you know, back in the 90s, but it That's was right. required, you know, 14 years ago. So one of the things that you really need to do is take this published guidance, this update, and make sure that you've implemented some of the things that they're talking about in there, or all of them. Or at least have them in for consideration to implement, because you need to keep this stuff updated. You know, compliance is, what do you call it? It's a breathing document, living, breathing document.
Yes, living, breathing document.
Well, Absolutely. The first thing they say in there is, you know, what do they call it? The new, and then call it actors, a new entrance into the healthcare industry. Right. You know, they're talking about, then they even go on page 79, they talk about financial incentives, ownership and payment, follow the money. We always say that. Where is the most That's fraud? Right. Follow the money. And they talk about that. One of the best way to identify fraud and abuse risk is to follow the money. And they talk about ownership. They even bring up private equity and payment incentives.
I was just going to bring that up, Terry.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the payment incentives, you know, are you getting paid based on how many people you see? Well, that can give you a risk of overutilization. You can't do that. You know, our patients being inappropriately steered towards more expensive items and services. And, you know, do you have something, let's say you have adopted some AI at some point. Remember, they're not perfect yet. And the oversight just started, which is unfortunate because it's going backwards. But you know, they're now putting oversight on something that already happened. It's like balancing your checkbook after you've already overdrawn it a few million dollars. And so now they're saying, you know, well, now we're going to take a look at that. But the problem is that it also is being run by, not run, but created by companies who have a financial stake in another company. So let's say that you have it in your EMR and you need a patient that needs to have some kind of orthopedic support. But let's say that AI company is tied to Zimmer. And so that's the only company that they give you. Well, you've got a huge compliance leak right now, because you can't do that. So there's some things that, whether you refer to, whether it's internal, you just need to make sure that, I mean, Sean and I could talk about compliance for days and not get through everything.
I would love to, you know, talk about private equity right now, but we can't because of time. But I do want to, maybe next week on our hashtag Terry Tuesday episode, I want to talk about PE. Sure. Yeah, I want to talk about PE, because I have several PE and venture capitalist groups that have come to us to provide due diligence. And when I talk to them about the importance of compliance, you know, they always say, well, you know, we exist in other industries, and, you know, healthcare is just a new sector for us. And, you know, we have lawyers, and, you know, we have our own compliance team. And I ask them if any of them have ever worked in healthcare before. And they're like, no, but, you know, they're lawyers and compliance professionals. Okay. Listen, that's like saying I'm going to have an OBGYN perform neurosurgery on
something. I know, right?
Oh, not happening. And I have one PE client right now, and I am so proud of them, because every time they put something forward to me and I say to them, I understand where you're going with this, but let's talk about the risks. Okay. Their response to me is, that's great, man. We never thought of that, because that's not our world. And this is why we depend on you. Let's go back to the drawing board. So I want to talk about PE next week, because I think number one, on page 79 of this document that, you know, you shared with us earlier, Terry, I think we can have an entire discussion about PE and all of the significant problems and traps that exist for venture capitalists and private equity money.
Well, and I think we could also expand on that with payment incentives and then financial arrangements tracking. So I think there's a lot to unpack there.
Let's do that next week.
Well, just so you know, it might be the week after, because I'm in Napa next week.
So la-di-da-da.
With my husband and my daughter and her husband. So
whatever, Terry.
Yeah, I know.
All right.
Week after.
All right. Well, we all wish you a fun trip to Napa. Have some wine for all of us. And to each and every single one of you, I wish you a good trip and enjoyable, whatever it is that you enjoy. All right. We'll be back later this week with a special episode of The Compliance Guy. I'm really excited about my upcoming guest. If you follow me on LinkedIn, you can see who that's going to be and what we're going to be talking about. And then Terry and I will be back in 2 weeks, but we will have, now will you be on the roundtable Monday or are you off on that one too?
I'm off on that Monday too. First okay. time. I've never missed the roundtable. Wow. Everyone else has missed at least once, but I haven't.
Wow. All
right. Know.
Well, okay. We're going to let this one slide. All right. And to each and every single one of you, thank you so much for tuning in, logging on, and hanging out with Terry and I just for a little while today. As I said, we'll be back later this week. So until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media @The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.